clear vision.
Yeah.
Keep the eye from growing so fast. And I actually took this, Chris, and I timed it with a separate, two separate groups of doctors. And no joke, like I was like, pretend I'm a 68-year-old patient with 20/30 cataracts. Talk me through what's happening. What do I need to do about it? Both groups of doctors, the one that I voluntold, took about 54 seconds to do the cataract conversation. And the way that we train our doctors, we can get the myopia conversation done 20 to 25 seconds and still really? Have a lasting impact, right? Create the problem, create the solution, get that emotional connection, get those benefits dialed in, and then move on. Yeah.
Hello and welcome to the Crystal Podcast on iCode Media. Today we're going live again, and I have my good friend, Dr. Justin Kwan, today. And I asked Justin to come and talk to us about kind of the uncertainties within myopia management. And I'll kind of set this up again in just a second. But ultimately, to me, the biggest challenge is we do a lot of myopia management in our practice, but I still have these uncertainties. And if I have these uncertainties, Justin, I suspect that a lot of other people, even as we would have all this experience, kind of these uncertainties. And so that's what I wanted to talk to you about. It kind of sets up our panel conversation that we're going to have next week, which I think will be a lot of fun as well. So thanks for doing this. As always, be sure to subscribe to the podcast, write a review, share it with your friends, and support those who support us. So, Justin, thanks for coming on. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about, you know, I think this conversation can be a little bit challenging because it can make us feel or make us sound like we're kind of holier than thou. I always find that when I have these conversations about like, you know, you got to do myopia management, you should mm-hmm. be doing this for your patients. It's kind of like, mm-hmm. yeah, Chris, but my practice is different and yeah. you know, you can do X, Y, and Z. And it's just, it's like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to have that. Like, I don't want to feel like I'm preachy to people.
Yeah.
So yeah. I'm going to let you preach. No, but I think the point is that there are these things that kind of circle around in my mind of like, okay, well, this is not probably going to be an issue for patients, for a lot of patients, until they're this old or that old. Like if we can hold on to things and not get them longer, it's just swirling in the back of my mind. And this creates uncertainties and doubts, and it mm-hmm. challenges our identities. You and I talked about identities a couple of weeks back. And so maybe that's where we start is give me a perspective on information that you have seen, or maybe your suspicion, if you don't have actual, you know, hard data. Mm-hmm. You know, when we think about seeing patients in that kind of prime range between, let's say, 6 years old and 12 years old, mm-hmm. and there's even patients earlier than that, what is your sense on how many of those patients are seeing optometry for comprehensive eye care?
Oh, gosh, very few. I think prior to entering kindergarten, there's a bit of an uptick, but really not where it should be, because as we look at census data, there's plenty of children age 4, 5, and 6 out there. Let's just say they make up 8% of the general population, and yet they're not making up 8% of our patient schedule. So yeah, a lot of room to grow into, especially for those young ones.
So when you look at practices that are, you know, that have incorporated at least 8% of their patient population in that age group. So you're saying 4, 5, and 6 is about 8% of the population. Is that correct?
Yeah, roughly speaking. Okay.
So then, so in a patient schedule, if I were seeing 20 patients a day, I'm just trying to break this down, then essentially I would see two a day that are in that population.
Yeah.
Okay.
Kindergarten.
And then what about the grade. Six? Yeah. What about the 6 to 12-year-old population? Do you know what that, that would show me?
That should be closer to about 12%, possibly.
Okay. So I should be seeing three of them a day?
Yeah, possibly.
So five patients of my 20-patient schedule should be kids under the age of 12.
Yeah, conceivably. And I think it does vary state by state, zip code by zip code. Even in retiree communities, there could be a zip code next door that is still young families. Last night I was in Arizona. That's a prime example. Because you think, oh, Phoenix, again, a lot of retirees, but Gilbert, Arizona, Chandler, Arizona, huge amount of young families. I think the average family unit has 3.26 kids or something, whereas the rest of the country might be just under 2, two kids per family unit. Yeah.
And so then what am I to make of, if I expect 20% of my patient population or the patients in my area should mm-hmm. be kids 12 and under, mm-hmm. What am I to make if I'm not seeing that? Cause I'll tell you right now, we're not, I mean, I do not see, you know, my patient population, I'm 42. I've got, mm-hmm. I've inherited a lot of my dad's patients as he's retired and before mm-hmm. he retired. You know, Dr. Lindsay in our practice, Lindsay Barrett in our practice, she, is not quite 10 years younger than me. So actually her birthday's mm-hmm. coming up and I won't tell you how old she is going to be, but she's not quite 10 years. She's a little less than 10 years younger than I am. Yeah. So, you know, she sees a lot of younger families. She sees more kids than I do for sure, but we're not mm-hmm. hitting that, you know, 1 in 5 patients. So why is that the case? Am I not marketing well? Am I not asking for referrals well? Are we abdicating that responsibility to somebody else who, yeah, what do you think about that?
I think that's okay because you're still likely trending above the rest of our colleagues across the country. I think the national average is 4 kids a week, let alone 4 kids a day. Wow. So it's pretty striking in that way. But yeah, I think it comes back to the systems, right? And the practices where the patients grow old with us, they conceivably have kids and grandkids. So is there an optician or checkout staff or even the check-in staff when they pull up authorizations and find the dependence on, let's just say, your VCP authorization? Like, are we asking the adults to schedule their kids then? Or are we, you know, either incentivizing or counting to make the, you know, checkout staff accountable that, hey, we had this adult or grandparent, we'd really like to get their kids scheduled. What happened to that? You know?
Mm-hmm. How do you respond to the response from the parents of, yeah, my child saw the, you know, the first time they come in, yeah, they saw the pediatrician last year, the year before. Like what's a good Justin Kwan response to that?
I probably like try to make an emotional connection. Like, you know, I have young children. We brought them to the pediatrician as well. And it may seem like their vision is all well and good, but did you know, always asking a question that typically a pediatrician only can check a couple of things. And as optometrists, our comprehensive eye exam evaluates, I think the number is over 20 components of the visual system and eye health, anatomy, physiology, and visual performance, right?
Getting young presbyopes into progressive lenses can be tough, but it doesn't have to be. Varilux Liberty 3.0 lenses are an introductory solution for new and young presbyopes, and they are available in select ad powers. This lens provides all-in-one balanced vision for an accessible and great first-time progressive lens wearing experience. Learn more about Varilux Liberty 3.0 lenses and get free resources to help start the progressive lens conversation with young presbyopes at slorpro.com/Varilux. As you know, patients with vitreous floaters are often frustrated by their symptoms. The challenge as clinicians is to offer solutions for our patients for vitreous floaters that are effective. But more often than not, the options of YAG vitreolysis and vitrectomy are not practical because the benefits don't outweigh the risks. That's where Vitreous Health from MacuHealth comes into play. Previously on the podcast, I've discussed the FLIES study with Dr. John Nolan, and the bottom line is that I can be confident prescribing this for my patients with floaters because I can tell them a large randomized placebo-controlled trial found that after 6 months of supplementation with Vitreous Health, floaters were reduced in size by approximately 30%, and 70% of patients had an improvement in their symptoms. Vitreous Health has been great for my patients, and we really feel like we have a viable option to treat patients with vitreous floaters now that we didn't have before. If you're not utilizing Vitreous Health for your patients, reach out to your MacuHealth representative now. Yeah, I think there's this, so I think that's one side of it is that patients think they're getting an eye exam at the nurse's office, at the school nurse's office, and at the pediatrician's office. Obviously, we clearly do different things.
Yeah.
But the other side of this that I've kind of been wondering a lot about is the identity side of, it's like, do I really, if I think about my practice, do I, are my behaviors reinforcing the identity that I believe it's really important for us to see kids, you know, of all ages. And we do, we'll see kids 6 months old. We'll see them less than that if they need to be seen. And we're happy to do them. But deep down I'm like, yeah, but my behaviors don't really say that I really want to see those patients. Like I want to, I'll tell you, I want to, and think I want to. Right. But like, we are not doing the things in our practice to really project that out into the community. So is it because you see, like, well, if I see a patient that's over the age of 65, I really know they're going to have, you know, likelihood of other ocular diseases that I'm really well equipped in my practice to manage. And I love to manage and I like to talk to those patients. Like, well, that's part of my belief system. But, you know, if I don't have that same real, like, oh, I'm going to be able to find amblyopia and find convergence insufficiency and myopia, and I can do something about that. I can improve their lives. Like, I think that, but maybe I don't fully believe it because I'm not doing the things that need to be done. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's totally fair, right? Because if we were to prioritize, as you've done before, the most prevalent eye health conditions, like there are things that really deserve our attention more than others in these adults, let's say 40 and older. So yes, our time is probably better spent not pushing out, you know, the wait time to get an appointment with you, you know, Dr. Wolf, to care for those patients first. But to maybe, carve out a half day, or if there's a minimum day in your school district, or some pocket of time where we can focus on the children more, even if 2 out of 3 are plus one hyperopes, you know, and like we have to sort of be okay with that, but again, set ourselves up for success and not forget about them. I think there's an intentionality to, you know, how do we manage the most pressing conditions?
Okay. So I think that's great. And I think, part of it in my mind is I just have to really sit down and kind of develop my identity a little bit more about around those things. And so in part of that, it's like, okay, well, if I'm expecting, we'll start with this, you know, with this mindset. And I also wonder about this. It's like, if most of those patients, cause my suspicion is we haven't made a big dent in the things that we're doing as a profession. You know, we are working on children's vision laws. We have been giving away care for longer than I've been in practice to try to reach out to the community to do care for children. But if you're still telling me that, you know, the average practice, did you say a month sees 4 patients?
4 children per week.
4 children per week. And your definition of children would be what age range?
17 and under. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah,
oh
I know.
Gosh. Okay, so 4 patients a week, 17 and under.
Yeah.
And we've been doing all these things, and they're great things, right? But something's not moving the needle. We're not really pushing patients into those realms. So is part of my, so I'm trying to think of like, what are the subconscious things that are holding me back? Like one might be that if I'm taking a managed vision care plan, and that's kind of an access point for a lot of patients.
Yes.
And subconsciously, if I haven't really incorporated like the fact that these patients are going to have other diseases that I manage, other things that I manage, the likelihood is less. Then if I'm not like a really gung ho myopia manager, right? Or if I don't have a specialty in binocular vision or something like that, then it's easy for me to be like, well, that's not, you know, that's not really what I knew. And also like from a practice revenue standpoint, if you're taking, if a lot of those patients don't need any prescription, then you're kind of like, well, I'm just giving away. I mean, I'm barely making the dollars that it's worth my time. And so I wonder if that is part of the thing that's in the back of my mind or others in the back of their mind where they're not conscious, it's just subconscious that's in like, that's changing my behavior and faltering my identity. But if that's the case, how do I get over that? How do I get over that? So then the next thing I would ask you is, okay, if 20% of my population should be under the age of 12 and I'm not even seeing 5 a week under the age of 17 on average, then what would I expect if I were going to start focusing on that? What should I expect in terms of like prevalence for amblyopia, convergence insufficiency, myopia in those age groups? What should I expect? So now I can start whittling down. It's like, okay, it's worth it for me to see all of these, and there's going to be a number of them that don't need anything from me. But if I take care of all of them, it's going to branch into all of these other categories that I can do something about. So kind of help me with that, that understanding. Yeah.
Probably where you live, the prevalence of myopia is not 35%. It's probably closer to 23%.
Yeah, and that's
so that's the biggest chunk.
23% in what age group?
Age 5 to 17.
Okay, great.
Yeah, 23%. And then for amblyopia, I'm not too sure on that. I would have to guess maybe like 2 to 4%. Yeah.
Yep, I think that's fair.
Yeah, and then for convergence insufficiency, depends on who you ask, but gosh, maybe 7 or 8%. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, if you dump in, I remember, you know, when I would help prepare people for boards, you know, the number I always remember, if you combine all binocular vision disorders, that would be like accommodated insufficiency, you know, convergence excess, convergence insufficiency, is basically like 20% of your patient population under the age of 18, pretty easy.
Together.
So, now you've got, in my patient population, you've got 28% of patients with myopia, 5 to 17. I probably have 20% with some other binocular vision disorder. And a lot of those are refractive, even if I don't want to do vision therapy in my practice. Mm-hmm. So now I'm up to 48%. Obviously, patients can have more,
they could
Bob Vandervoort. But okay, so we're at 48% plus 2 to 4% with amblyopia. So now we're 50%. And that doesn't even factor in allergies, blepharitis, which we see often in those patient categories. So we're at 50%. Okay, so now I can start to believe a little bit more of like, all right, so now my expectation would be one every other child that I'm seeing, if I really go all in, they do need me. At minimum, they need me for something.
Yeah.
Right? Absolutely. And that doesn't even factor in. I didn't even ask you about hyperopia that needs to be intervened on. What would that be?
Oh, totally. anything more than plus 150, plus two, that just needs vision correction. That's a contact lens patient. Yeah.
Yep.
Potentially. Yeah.
Yeah.
But really quickly thinking about the binocular vision part, I believe there is some peer-reviewed evidence about exotropia, intermittent exotropia, and when the eyes are not coordinated, there is this signal for the eye to elongate excessively, which, as we know, that's myopia. So there's a little bit of a tie-in or interplay between those kind of things. Like in the absence of a strong signal, the eye just like, heck, I'm going to grow longer.
And well, and also, I mean, even just those extra myopic prescriptions help with, you know, fusional convergence. And again, fusional convergence, is that going to change the amount of, you know, if you get a little bit more myopic, and even those patients, a lot of times, as you know, will prefer a click or two more minus because it helps with their fusion. And is that fusional convergence going to increase axial elongation even more? I mean, It's uncertain. It's one of the things that we're uncertain about, but it does make some sense.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
All right. So now we've kind of put a little bit more concrete in terms of the certainty of what I should expect in my patient population. And now I can enter into it again. This is helpful for me is because I can start thinking like, okay, now I'm expecting if I really go all in on kids, it's not like a handful of them need my help. It's really like half of them need something from me.
That's
right.
That's a great perspective. Yeah.
And probably more, but half is a very conservative. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay. That's helpful. Next, uncertainty is probably a little bit more challenging for me, for sure. And for other people is, okay, get me to the idea, Justin, that if I do something now, how much myopia can I spare? So we're going to use MySight. It's, we've got tons of data on MySight. But how much myopia can I spare with intervention, and how do I know I'm doing good in the long term? Like, how can I be really confident that what I do today is not just going to cost more money for a patient that otherwise isn't going to be a rapid progressor? Like, tell me about that.
Yeah, for sure. So I think going back a few years, there was a paper that said, whether you treat 4 years or 7 years, feels like the literature says we can save a maximum of a diopter. But now we have really robust virtual control groups. And as we look time and time again through the MySight data, looks like we can save about 0.53 millimeters of axial growth across 6 years. That translates to about 1.3 diopters, so kind of inching above that one diopter cap that was previously thought. So that's exciting. We know every diopter matters. So every diopter saved reduces the risk of myopic maculopathy by 40%, according to Mark Bullimore.
Yeah, Bullimore, yep.
Yeah, but I think what's really important for your listeners is that, of course, the earlier we start, the better, because that's when that child is that car going 100 miles per hour. There is this concept of like a year one boost. And I think at Last Academy, Noel Brennan said years two and three, that those savings added together are about the same as the year one savings. So after the first 3 years, you kind of get diminishing returns, partly because the child's older, they're naturally slowing down. But yeah, your absolute value of savings is gigantic when the child's 8, 9, rather than starting to treat at age 13, 14, 15. Not to say that we don't want to help those teenagers. Ideally, we graduate them from high school no worse than -3. But if we're looking at a cost-benefit ratio, man, 1 year early is a dollar per diopter. I haven't done that calculation necessarily, but man, yeah.
Well, we should do that. Early, okay, so let's. So here's what I want to do. I'm just going to use a number. So again, this is not, I'm not telling you what to charge. CooperVision's not telling you what to charge or to price lenses at. That's not the point here, right? But let's just assume, just to, for easy math, if it was $1,000, right? Yeah. If it was $1,000 a year in all in costs of out of, even if it's out of pocket, let's just say it's out of pocket cash. Yeah. Okay. $1,000 a year.
Okay.
And so that's, let's say they just do it for 3 years. That's, that's $3,000.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So that saves how many diopters? 1.3.
Yeah. So let's take the two examples of an 8-year-old treated for 2 years. So it's going to cost $2,000 to save that 8-year-old a diopter, because when we're starting at age 8, we can save a diopter in less time. But if we start a 12-year-old, regardless if they're -1 or -2, it's probably going to take 5 years to save a diopter.
Interesting. Yeah. Wow. So
$5,000, man, that's a lot more expensive when you start later. Yeah.
Yeah. That's really interesting. So, so even if we took the approach, and I know this isn't what you're saying, but even if we took the approach of like, look, the very first thing we're going to do, we're not going to put them in a soft lens right away and then see how they do and see if they progress. It's like, no, we're going to have we're going to have as minimal progression as we possibly can, put them in a soft lens that controls for myopia as opposed to one that does not.
Yep.
And we just do it for a year. And let's say they fail out after a year or it becomes too costly or anything, like any of those other options. We're basically, it becomes a lot more effective.
We did them a world of good. And because my site hasn't been shown to have a rebound effect, like that 1 year was time and money well spent. And I think, Dr. Brianna Rue often says to the families, can we just get 1 year? I know it's expensive. Can we just get 1 year first? And then you kind of hook them a little bit. Worst case scenario, like you said, they stop at 1 year. But best case scenario, they do 2 to 4 years. And that's really the initiation is really helpful. Yeah.
So I'll give you a story. I mean, my oldest daughter is 17 years old. And before my site was available, she did orthokeratology. And she did that for probably 2 years. And then my site was available and she did my site for a year. And then she just became she wanted a little bit sharper distance vision. And so for the last 2 years, she's been in, 2 years, she's been in just a spherical contact lens and she hasn't budged, so she's 17. Yeah. We started her at 11 when she first started getting myopic and she's like a 3-4 diopter myope. Right. Oh, and she hasn't budged since she was 11 years old.
Yeah.
And,
great.
You think about it and it's like, I didn't hesitate with her, I didn't hesitate with what we're going to do as soon as we saw it. I don't hesitate with any of my other kids. And so, I do think the biggest challenge that I find is like going from orthokeratology for her to my site, she had a little bit of an adjustment because she was used to really sharp, crisp vision. But once she overcame that, it was no big deal. Whereas when I put patients right away into my site, they've never been in anything else before, they'll see 20/20 and they're not even bothered at all by any peripheral blur.
Yeah, it's probably because on OrthoK, the tangential map is maybe 4.5 millimeters mm-hmm. of clear central. And then the MySight is 3.3-ish. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Which thankfully is still larger than most presbyopic multifocals.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that, I mean, that's helpful to me because it does kind of suggest that, I mean, that's helpful with uncertainty, right? It's helpful for me to just kind of work through this. Like, yeah, don't wait. Waiting is actually harder. Right. It's harder. Yeah. And also, even if this isn't financially, a big deal in the long term or isn't financially viable for the patient in the long term, even in the short term, when it's early can be more beneficial.
Can be huge. Yeah. Yeah.
It's good.
And one of our most successful eye doctors, we can either call them same day conversions. I know some practices see the family back for a consultation that includes baseline topography, axial length, and what have you. But yeah, our most successful doctors, because the fit set is in the office, they're like, hey, you're here for your comprehensive eye exam. We're going to put these MySight lenses on. They were designed for children just like you. You have a week to think about it because we would have done this anyway with any other contact lens, like you said, Chris. Mm-hmm. So it actually kind of skips the consultation in a way because they were pre-identified. Just the minimal testing to get started. And we just kind of follow the same course in the initial week and then add the 6 month later. Because let's just say for a brand new single vision daily disposable, you're going to just, again, for round number's sake, it's going to be $150. Insertion removal, 1 week follow-up, and then purchase the annual supply. That $150 could get credited towards the cost of the myopia control program. And that way it's like, oh, I'm not spending this like $1,000 or $1,500 up front. I'm just going to march along the same fee schedule, if you will, and then collect the balance the 1 week.
Yeah, I think we make it too special in our own minds. You know, you've probably heard me and me talk about this before, but I suffer from that. You know, it's like, well, this is different, so I got to talk about it differently to patients. And I'll tell you, like, the easiest time I have with patients on my side is when I say, hey, we have a new lens that actually not only makes your son see better, but will also help slow down so he's not getting as nearsighted as fast.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like, we'll put him on. And the patient's like, yeah, it's great. Yeah, of course. Why wouldn't I do that? You know? Yeah. Whereas if I do treat it, and I think there's certain things we do that do need to be treated slightly differently.
Oh yeah.
I've found this isn't one of them. I mean, honestly, of course you're going to follow up with patients a little bit more closely instead of letting them go for a year, you're seeing them at 6 months so you can titrate that. But
yeah.
I find that if I can keep this as close to the other things that I do in terms of it makes it feel, it is special, but it makes it feel normal. As opposed to weird, you know?
Yeah. I mean, what Dr. Sclafani says is like, is it the eye of the child that's special? Is it the lens that's special? Or is it what we do as a doctor and team? Is that special? Like, where does this whole specialty definition reside? Mm. And I think there's nuances we can dig into a little bit, but essentially the FDA approval to slow the progression makes it easy. Yeah. We all can fit daily disposable soft lenses. That's easy. You just mentioned the conversation is easy. In fact, a doctor told me, this is true, it takes longer to talk about cataracts than it does myopia management. We can really just say the eye is growing too long, too fast, getting weaker. My job is to protect your child's vision from getting worse as it grows. And again, this lens was designed for that very purpose for your child. It'll do those two things that you talked about. Clear vision.
Yeah.
Keep the eye from growing so fast. And I actually took this, Chris, and I timed it with two separate groups of doctors. And no joke, like I was like, pretend I'm a 68-year-old patient with 20/30 cataracts. Talk me through what's happening. What do I need to do about it? both groups of doctors, the one that I voluntold, took about 54 seconds to do the cataract conversation. And the way that we train our doctors, we can get the myopia conversation done 20 to 25 seconds and still have a lasting impact, right? Create the problem, create the solution, get that emotional connection, get those benefits dialed in, and then move on. Yeah.
Okay. So, I want to be able to do that in 20 seconds. Did I do it in 20? I could do it better. I like the fact that you said the eye is getting longer, getting more myopic, getting weaker. Yeah. And my job is to protect your sight now and in the future.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, I love that. I love that. And, you know, obviously I'll put a little spin on it. It won't sound as good as you, but but I like that.
And in fact, you know, we always talk about, oh, we do evidence-based things. And I think lately, or in the past couple of years, I've been really cognizant of like our communication ought to be evidence-based as well. That's a whole realm of PubMed I haven't even looked into necessarily, but just, you know, hearing great speakers and reading some business books as well. Like the communication part is huge. And why can't that be evidence-based to make everything more effective?
I think, so what I've found, you know, and not just in working in my own practice, but when I consult outside of the, of my practice, what's really, really powerful for patient conversations. And I think about this as I have to remove myself from getting in the way of what you should, what is in your best interest as the patient.
Yeah.
So when I don't use effective words with a patient, I am putting myself in their way. Mm-hmm. Or when I'm assuming that, this isn't that big of a problem for them, then I'm putting myself in their way as opposed to being more objective. So the more objective I am and the more times I can cite other data that tells me what we can do, I think the more effective I become. So I've learned that, you know, if I say things like based on our clinical practice guidelines, this is what I should do. Right. Mm-hmm. Or based on this study that shows us we can slow down your progression by 59%, that now I'm abdicating some of that authority so that it's not just Chris Wolf telling you what you should do. It's Chris Wolf saying like, this is what I would do. This is my clinical experience, but this is also how I'm informed by the literature. And I think you're right. I think that's a very powerful statement because, and it also does another thing, Justin, which is, that I think creates a lot of uncertainty in a lot of doctors' minds is if I go all in with you on this treatment and that treatment doesn't work, then whose fault is it? It's my fault, right? This is like, again, one of those little things in the back of the brain. Then it's like, well, I have this kind of concern that if I go all in on, I see this often with doctors and practices on like dry eye devices.
Yes.
And I think the mistake that we often make with a dry eye device or treatment is we have, again, when we don't have a holistic approach to managing the disease state of dry eye and we buy something new and say, I want to plug that widget into dry eye and make that widget work, as opposed to let's make dry eye work and we'll figure out where the widgets work within dry eye. I think there's this holdback because when you do something and you don't know what to expect because you either haven't looked at the literature deeply or you don't have the clinical experience to see where it's going to fit into your practice. Then if a patient comes back and this related to myopia, it's like, okay, a patient comes back in 6 months and they're worse. Am I a failure? Like I'm the failure now, you know? Whereas if I'm citing that data, I'm saying like, look, this is what my clinical practice informs me. This is what the literature informs me to do. I'm telling you that there might be still some progression, but we're going to get a lot less progression. And this is what we expect. So, so now I'm even taking some of the like weight off my own shoulders.
So I
don't have that uncertainty of like, well, if this doesn't work, you know, even if it works, but it's like, my mind is like, it didn't work because it got more nearsighted. It's like, no, that's not how it works, but also for the patient. So I think that's very helpful in managing that uncertainty in my mind. The most common questions I get include, what ophthalmological codes or evaluation and management codes should I use? What ICD-10 codes do I need to bill with this CPT code? What CPT codes can be billed together and what can't? And my favorite, How do I manage a patient who has diabetes who comes in for a quote unquote routine eye exam? These questions really highlight the confusion and uncertainty that serves as a daunting hurdle for providers, makes it more challenging for them to care for their patients and provide those patients with the best opportunity for a lifetime of ocular health and clear vision. That's why we built iCode Education for this specific purpose. Our mission is to provide optometrists with resources to help you understand disease states, revenue cycles, and billing and coding so that you can put that on autopilot and truly care for your patients. Check out iCodeEducation.com. That's E-Y-E-C-O-D-E education.com. We've developed a premier billing and coding bundle that includes all of our billing and coding resources in one place. We also have a 10% discount code just for listeners of this podcast. Enter the coupon code EYECODEMEDIA22 at checkout. We'd love to work with you. Check out iCodeEducation.com. Emerging presbyopes and emmetropic presbyopes can be tricky. These patients want and need additional help at near, but they can be resistant to solutions that create even mild distance blur. The MyDay multifocal lens has been great for our presbyopic patients. It allows those patients to transition into a multifocal more easily and more comfortably. And we've had this lens for long enough now that we have been able to see the simple and how simple the adaptation can be when adjusting from lower AD designs to higher AD designs. When prescribing MyDay contact lenses, you can feel confident about your environmental impact because for every MyDay contact lens sold in the United States, CooperVision's partner, Plastic Blank, collects and converts an equal amount of ocean-bound plastic through their global network. MyDay multifocal contact lenses will provide your patients with a great quality of vision and comfortable lens wearing experience, all while making a difference in our environment. So if you haven't started utilizing MyDay multifocal in your practice, I'd encourage you to reach out to your CooperVision representative to get started.
Yeah, I remember when I was doing a ton of dry eye in Southern California, same exact thing. Like, you're jumping from one treatment to the next and the patient's like losing confidence because, oh, this didn't work, then that didn't work. And you didn't, or we didn't articulate like the expectations exactly. And the long-term game plan. Should I have ordered blood work sooner for autoimmune and things like that? So I think that's an important roadmap to stage out for the patient in both conditions, myopia and dry eye both. And we all know that no treatment works perfectly, but it does feel like a punch in the gut when they've dropped so much money for it. And you're like, well, nothing works perfectly. And like, you can, Chris, absolutely blame the device because, right. You know, it was studied as such. It wasn't Chris's fault. You know, it was the device's fault, if you will. But yeah, definitely reframing it as it could have been a lot worse, which I briefly want to touch on that my site actually worked.
To that point, I want to listen to this in a second, but to that point, if you do it again, the communication is really important because if I do it after it doesn't work, it doesn't quote unquote work, then I'm just blaming a device. But if I just say, look, like maybe at that contact lens follow-up, maybe I don't even take a lot of time at the comprehensive exam when I'm putting the contact lens on and I say, we're going to slow, et cetera, but maybe instead of, you know, that 5 minute to 10 minute follow-up, it's mostly just about education. Like, this is what we're going to expect in 6 months. Maybe we're going to see a little bit of progression, but it should be dramatically lower, 60% lower, about 60% lower than what we would have expected if we did nothing. Mm-hmm.
And so there's still a chance your child will have a growth spurt.
Yeah. And now that communication is removing that barrier for the patient to wonder about that. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's giving them correct expectations.
Yeah. A lot of the recent low dose atropine literature, I know there's some commercial entities coming out with 3+ year data as well. They're trying to split it into response and responders and non-responders, essentially, because when you take the averages, it is what it is. The effect size is like, small or modest. I don't know which one is better to say out loud. But at the end of the day, my site works in 90% of children. And then prostaglandin analogs to reduce IOP work 85% of the time. So thankfully, my site edges out prostaglandins a little bit. Maybe you've heard me say this too. What's the response rate of metformin to lower blood sugar? Do you have any clue?
I haven't heard you say that. No. What is it?
Yeah. It's 50%, Chris. It's a coin flip. So that actually should improve our confidence in MyCite when you think about metformin and prostaglandins as lower response rates. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And I think that's, you know, I did an episode a couple of weeks back related to headaches and just kind of giving ourselves that perspective of like, I think we are a little jaded in eye care because we can take a patient who is a minus 11.
Yeah,
and can see, you know, what 20. Yeah, I know I'm using examples close to me right now.
Yeah.
So we take a minus 11. I mean, what would be the uncorrected visual acuity on that? I mean, at distance,
even 20? Pinhole would be like 2100. Like, it's just so blurry.
Yeah. So, but we can take that patient and make them give them perfect vision, right?
Yeah.
With an optical device.
Yeah.
And so, like, there's almost nothing else in healthcare where you can take a patient who is completely disabled.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And make them completely normal. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, function completely normal. I know there's some other deficits when you put the lens in front of the eye versus the contact lens, all that kind of stuff, but
yeah.
Completely normal with a seemingly simple intervention, although it's quite complex, but we feel it's relatively simple. Mm-hmm. And so that jades our perspective, man. I think it really, it
gives us medicine and treatments don't respond that way.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And if you grow up in that field of like internal medicine, family medicine, it's like,
you know,
50% of the time. Yeah. 50% of the time, it's not going to help you.
And there's always a range of outcomes. And like, you don't know if that patient's going to be on the left side of the bell curve, the right side of the bell curve, or right at that average middle point. Mm. And it's something we, like you said, live with every day, but how do we explain that well to a family that's like looking at us, you know, eye to eye?
Yeah. Yeah. But to say, I mean, but again, to say, just as you did, I mean, I think that helps with uncertainty, right? We take what we know, which is spectacle correction, right? And we got to say, well, that's not entirely perfect. So let's look at other things that we know well. Okay. Glaucoma. Okay. I can lower your pressure with a prostaglandin analog. I can lower your pressure by 30% in 85% of patients. SLT. I can lower your pressure by 20% in 80% of patients. Okay. Well, now what if I took the same thing? I can reduce your progression, right? I can reduce your risk by 59% axial length, right? 59% on axial length, 52% on refractive error.
Other way. Yeah. Okay. Other way.
59% on refractive error, 52% on axial length. It's early for me. It's early for me.
I know. Yeah.
And
be confident 90% of the time it'll do that.
It will do that 90% of the time. That helps me with uncertainty.
That's good.
Yeah. And so, and then the last piece I want to cover here with you is, what about like, okay, so you said myopic maculopathy and you use the minus 3 as kind of the threshold.
Yeah.
So myopic maculopathy, glaucoma risk, retinal holes, tears, retinal detachments. Okay. What's the magic about keeping a patient under minus 3 and why should I care then? And if that magic is true, then I really do care about that, you know, quarter diopter myope when they're six years old.
Yeah. 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 So a lot of this stems from Ian Flitcroft, like summarizing all as much as what's known about myopic maculopathy. And of course the subsequent International Myopia Institute papers. Tying it back to dry eye with the TFOS and the DEWS and things like that, they put out reports every 2 to 4 years. The IMI has put out reports every 2 years since 2019. But where we see the between minus 3 and minus 4 is when that risk or the odds ratios of myopic maculopathy begin to exponentially increase. And I think we've talked about this before, where if you grab all the minus 4 adults in the world, only 2% of them get myopic maculopathy. So I want to, you know, separate the like 40x, 270x increase.
Right, right. That's a very challenging, at first blush, it's very impactful. But when you try to unpack it to say, how many patients am I actually impacting? Mm-hmm. We need to know more. So please go. Yeah this is
great. Yeah, yeah. So I think the number is for glaucoma, separate from myopia and all that, like 2% of adults 40 and older will have glaucoma. And that's where I kind of position that, you know, it's like, okay, we need to make sure almost nobody becomes minus 4 because that's when 2% of them get myopic maculopathy. Mm. But we always tell stories in our patient communication, or when you and I are, speaking from the stage, it's like, this story is real quick. My wife's cousin-in-law, their whole family, two kids were vacationing in South Korea. He gets flashes and floaters. Like, uh-oh, is it a PVD? Mm. But thankfully he walked into an ophthalmology practice in a foreign country, had a horseshoe retinal tear, and now a year later is still living with epiretinal membrane as an anesthesiologist. And he's your age. He's 42. My age as well, I guess. But yeah, that's what I'm like, oh my goodness. Like, if I was him, what would I do? And now, if we're allowed to live past the age of 80, that's half of our life. So yeah. I think about that because yes, we're high myopes, but yes, I think there was something posted the other day that a minus 150 had myopic maculopathy as well. So it's that whole range of there's no safe level of myopia, which is why I'm like, again, so committed to this, like making sure they finish high school no worse than -3.
Yeah. Cool. All right. So now I think I've got the uncertainties. Leave me with, last couple minutes, leave me with, you did mention some best practices, but let's say I want to go all in and really try to make up that 20% of my patient population is kids 12 and under, right? Or 17 and under, 12 and under.
Yeah.
So what should I be doing? You mentioned some mining data, but what do you see the really high functioning practices doing?
Yeah, I would say in the team huddles and team meetings, make sure we revisit this in repetition, maybe like 3 team huddles in a row. Make sure they understand the gravity, the standard of care. Maybe share, again, a happy myopia patient that we helped, and then maybe a sad story of maybe an adult that was affected by myopia complications, to again create the wins and the losses a little bit, right? To kind of see how, wow, we do have a patient base that is living with this and suffering from this, but we can actually have great results. I initially, for practices starting out, maybe not yours, I would just aim for 10 conversations a week, because, like Major League Baseball, even if you're only successful 1 out of 3 times, you're doing pretty good. And it still comes down to each and every child. We don't know if that child's going to be an Olympic athlete or just your average Joe. Whatever it is, every child deserves, again, to have a lifetime of healthy vision. And so I think, if we can hold ourselves accountable to 10 conversations a week and unpack why those did or didn't happen, we can course correct the next week and maybe keep that at the forefront until we've reached the numbers and, again, form the systems that support us to get there, because our motivation comes and goes, right?
Yeah, that's right. I think you do have to keep it all in mind. And I like the idea of doing things in quarters, right? So let's tackle it this quarter, see if we can get a movement, reassess our metrics, right? So a metric could be very easy is I'll mine my data for this quarter to see about how many, we go back to first quarter 2024, or maybe even it's a year ago, and we could say, okay, well, second quarter of 2023, how many of our patients were at this age, right? And then just run a report in our EHR.
Yep.
And then, okay, well, let's say we have a conversation at the front desk, or our, we outsource our phones now. So we've got a guy, and he's been awesome. I got to have a whole other conversation about how that has really impacted our practice. But he has nothing to do but focus on filling empty slots, right? Nice, he's not worried about the patient coming in. Yeah. And what I really think is cool is if we have a patient drop off at 2:30, let's say it's 11:30 in the morning and they drop off at 2:30 in the afternoon because they reschedule or whatever.
Yeah.
He'll fill it. Where our when we were having that in-house, we would talk about that, but part of me would be like, oh, my schedule's a little lighter. And I know everybody else in the office thought the same thing, subconsciously, but he'll fill it. And so it could be like, I'll be like, and so it's great. And the other thing is when somebody's calling, he can do this stuff of like, hey, Mrs. Smith, I'm noticing that, you have so-and-so or such-and-such, they haven't been in a year or 2 years, or, being able to identify that stuff. Anybody else in your family? Any kids in your family that you need to schedule? I mean, we could plant those seeds and then just reassess, right? That could be the only change we make. It could be all on Ignacio, right?
Yeah.
And then when we reassess next quarter, like, did we make a movement? You know, did we see this?
Yeah.
So anyway, I like that. I like that. All right. Well, Justin Kwan, I'll be respectful of your time. Thanks so much for doing this live stream. I think it was a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on, Chris. Always good to learn from you.